The history of cooking is full of information about the history of spices. Everything from salt to the Great Spice Trail has influenced the way that we eat and the way that we perceive and sense our foods. My guest today is Dr. Stuart Ferriment. He is a medical doctor turned food scientist, and he uses the periodic table of spices as a starting point to create an adventurous recipe book that explores the science and art behind making spice blends to release flavors in our food. We talk today about how when we taste food, the taste is not only on our tongue, but throughout our entire body. And we also talk about how to conceptually approach combining spices for maximum flavor. This is The Lindsay Elmore Show.
Welcome to The Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast for people who deserve to be healthy, with honest, open and enlightening conversations with doctors, thought leaders, creatives, and spiritual gurus, you'll walk away with simple and tangible tips and tricks that allow you to live your healthiest life so you can pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark.
Medical doctor turned food scientist and author of DK bestsellers, Dr. Stu is a science and medical writer, presenter, and educator. For over 7 years, he has been the food scientist on BBC's Inside the Factory. He makes regular appearances on UK TV, radio, and at public events, and his writing appears in national and international publications, including BBC Science Focus, The Independent, The Daily Mail, and The New Scientist. His books include The Science of Cooking, The Science of Spice, and The Science of Living. His personal background is greatly inspirational to others because in 2008, he was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor, which, following a successful surgery, forced him to leave active medical practice. Retraining as an education health sciences lecturer, he discovered a passion for science communication and something that he is now fortunate to do full time. Today, we're going to be talking about his book, The Science of Spice, where he uses the periodic table of spices as a starting point to create an adventurous recipe book that explores the science behind the science and art behind making incredible spice blends to help release the flavor in your dishes. Dr. Stuart Ferriment, welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Thank you so much for having me on. Really great to see you. Really great to meet you.
I am thrilled to get to meet you as well, because I think it was about 2 years ago that I was going through the bookstore and I saw your gorgeous book, The Science of Spice, and have been so inspired by it, have learned so much from it. And I love the idea that we have our own little apothecaries right at our disposal when it comes to herbs and spices. And so, you know, listeners today, if you love what we talk about, we've also got an interview with Juliet Blankenspor on the show talking about herbs, but the science of spice is what we are digging into today. So one of the things that's so cool about your book is how you break down where in the world things are from, and you also have these really cool charts that help to break down all of the chemical constituents that are in various spices that lend their own unique flavors, aromas, and potentially even healing benefits. So talk to us about the chemistry of spice.
Yeah, sure. So the book is written specifically just about spices. And it's a book that's unlike anything that I've ever seen before. And that's kind of the reason why we wanted to write this. And what I've done in the book is I've explained where flavors come from and why they come from, why you get flavors from in spices, and why that's so important. And what it is that whenever we eat something, the flavors that we appreciate. So Lindsay, when I say, Here's an apple, eat this apple, where are you tasting that apple? What would you say, Lindsay?
Well, being a chemist, I'd be like, it's the malic acid. But when you think of an apple, I guess it really depends on which apple you're talking about, because, you know, you've got tartness in things like Granny Smith apples, but then you've got really pronounced sweetness in something like a Pink Lady apple versus a crispy, you know, because the crispiness of like a Honeycrisp apple gives it a certain mouthfeel. They're all so dramatically different.
But whereabouts in your body do you taste it?
Well, I mean, you certainly have all of your sensory receptors inside of your mouth, but the cool thing about our taste bud receptors is, you know, I happen to know that they're distributed all throughout the body. So you're equally tasting things in your liver, in your GI tract, sometimes in your lungs. You're certainly tasting the aromas of food to kind of put that synesthesia of like crossover of our senses. But, you know, we eat with our eyes, we eat with our nose before we even take in that flavor.
This is the crazy thing that's probably going to blow your mind, is that those flavors, those apple-y flavors or whatever it is, these spicy flavors, the things that make food so wonderful, nearly all of it is experienced through the nose. And you can appreciate this is that if you eat something, so if you've got a kid and you need to give them medicine, then one way to help them to get the medicine go down is to pinch your nose. And you can try this. You get a really, you know, aniseed or something, a really strong flavored candy, and you put it in your mouth and you chew it. Keep your finger on your nose when you eat it. It will taste sweet. You might have some tanginess in there. It'd be quite pleasant. But as soon as you release your nose, take your fingers off your nose, air will be able to flow through your nose. And all of a sudden, you'll get all the flavors. It might be lemony, it might be orange or something. But up until that point, you can't actually taste anything other than the basic taste, sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami, which is a sort of a savory flavor that you taste that you get with soy sauces and shiitake mushrooms and things like that. But so the key to understanding foods, why they taste great and what foods go together well, and ultimately spices, why we use spices, how to use them best, is to understand the chemicals in them, which we call flavor compounds. And these are the substances that give foods their flavor. Every single food that has a flavor has these flavor compounds. Coffee, for example, has over 200 flavor compounds. There's probably about 1,000, but we're discovering them all the time. And what happens when you ever put food into your mouth, you're chewing it, you think you're tasting it on your tongue, but in reality, those sensations are coming from your nose. The aromas of that food as you're chewing it in your mouth, the vapors from that, they contain these flavor compounds, and they waft up the back of your throat into the back of your nasal cavity. And the smell sensors there at the back of the nasal cavity, they sense it like you would smell when you're sniffing. But when it comes from the back, your brain interprets that as if it's coming from your tongue. So you taste all these flavors on your tongue. That's actually a hallucination that your brain creates from these smells that are hitting the back of your nose, which is only when you get when you eat something. So that's the nature of flavor and taste, which is something most of us don't appreciate. You know, I ask you where you taste an apple, and most people say, well, I'll taste it on my tongue. But actually, and you're quite right, the taste receptors are important, and they are all throughout the GI tract, and they have important roles in food and digestion. But specifically, if we want to drill down into the flavors of food and how we make them work best for us, we look at these flavor compounds. And there's lots of different research out there on different foods and the flavor compounds that are in them, because food scientists are really interested, because if you can harness what those flavor compounds are, you can actually extract it and then use it. So flavor scientists use it all the time. So banana, you can extract the chemical, the flavor compound that gives banana flavor, and then you can put it in, say, a yogurt or something, and then it tastes like a banana. But as more of a sort of a cook person, I love cooking with a scientific background, is that it's just to understand what they are, and you can actually discover a lot about them and actually how they blend together. So the chemicals within spices are actually held up, little droplets of oil that are embedded within the outer coat of the spice. So most spices, let's say it's a seed, within that seed it's this hard thing, this hard little part of a plant, but within it, it's got these little droplets of oil, and in those droplets of oil, loaded with these flavor compounds. And these flavor compounds exist as a defense for the plant. So a spice is any part of a plant that is highly flavored that we use in small quantities to flavor our food. Herbs are something different. Herbs are the green parts of a plant. Spices are any other part of the plant other than the green part, the leafy part, that we'd use. Often we use dried, and we call these spices. So it can be bark, as in with cinnamon. It can be the roots or the rhizomes, as you have with ginger and turmeric. It can be the seeds. It can be the and actually, often when we think of seeds, they're actually the fruits of the seeds. So the little things that we get there that are dried up, and that we grind them into a pestle and mortar, or we get as a powder in a little jar. Those things, they're either the seeds or the fruits of that plant that's been dried, ground down, and served up to you. And it's loaded with all those flavor compounds. And so when you add them to your food, I liken it to, if you're a musician, if you're making a composition, if you're making an orchestral piece, if you're not using spices, like, you're missing the whole string section. You're missing major parts of it, because it's what brings food to life. Without these flavor compounds, and spices just inject food with life.
Absolutely. I was remembering earlier this morning, and it's interesting that you would liken using spices to an orchestra. Because I remember when I was in sixth grade, I think I was in a production of the best Christmas pageant ever. And I remember when the music director was instructing us about how we really needed to nail all of our a cappella parts, or all of the harmony parts, excuse me. She said, if you don't do it, it's gonna be very vanilla. And it's the same as what you are saying, is if you don't add spice to your food, you are going to end up having very bland food. And a friend of mine has anosmia since birth, so she's never been able to have a sense of smell. And it's so crazy to sit with her with spices or essential oils or candles or really highly aromatized scents, and her just go, it smells like air. It smells like nothing. And it served her well in the hospital, because there are so many, not nice smells in the hospital, and she couldn't smell any of it. So she would always be able to go in and take care of those patients without having the aversion that the rest of us did. Now, I do want to dive into some specific compounds, but I'd like to take one big step back. Do you think that the fact that food is experienced in the nose, and that what we are actually tasting is these flavor compounds that hit the back of the nasal cavity, do you think that is because the sense of smell is so ancient compared to all of our other senses?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the first sense that you become aware of. Before you open your eyes, you smell your mother. It's the most primal sense that we have. Even plants can smell. Pretty much every animal I can think of that I've found has a sense of smell. Now, as I say, plants, they can sense vapors. And many of these flavor compounds are just that. They are vapors that plants release to communicate to one another, to alert another plant. I'm being attacked. Then they will mount an immune response. The trees or the plants will actually do that. They'll communicate with one another. Or the flavor compounds called terpenes, for example, which I mentioned in the book. And there's terpenes are the largest group of chemicals of flavor compounds. With the book, what I wanted to do was I wanted to explore these flavor compounds, and I went through the 200 plus different spices that we looked at in the book, and I went through, drilled into all the research of the flavor compounds in each of the different spices. And from that, I realized that there were some common themes coming through of different flavors and how the different flavor compounds tied up with different flavors. And so I've grouped them into different flavor compounds, which I've put into what I kind of call my periodic table of spices. And from that, you can see which spices are of the same family, so you can interchange them very easily, which are from different families. So if you've got a spice blend that, and maybe you're missing a spice, maybe you don't have the cinnamon, for example, in the spice, you can look in the on the periodic table and go, ah, but I have that spice, and then you can swap it out. Or even you want to, the fun thing is that within the book, we go across the world and we look at spice blends from across the globe, and We've got chefs and locals in different parts of the world to say, these are the spice blends that we use. Here's some recipes. This is what we use. But then if you use the periodic table in the book, which shows you the flavor compounds in each spice and what flavors they have, maybe it's a woody note, it's a nutty note, maybe it's a sort of a citrusy or a floral or a, you know, a fruity note. And from that, suggest pairings of food and different spices that you can blend with that spice. And you can build your own spice blends up and you can experiment with different spices. So that's what it's, so this is how the flavor compounds is empowering for you as a cook. Because I think ultimately we don't appreciate spices very much. They become things in a jar that we put in the back of the, in the back of the kitchen cupboard that we maybe use once for a recipe and then never use again. But if we harness them and we understand how to use them and we're not scared of them, then we can bring our food to life. And you're quite right about health. There's been some research, I think it was a 2021 paper, that found that spices help the gut microbiome, which is the microbes, the bacteria that live within the gut itself. The more varied food that we have, if you can get into your week, Lindsay, 30 different kinds of plants in your diet, then research conclusively shows that you will have a more diverse spectrum of bacteria living in your gut, which will make you healthier, it will make you happier, it'll give you a stronger immune system for all your well-being. It will boost all of that because our gut and our body and our brain are also closely intrinsically linked. So yes, spices are really important for health, and actually you can just add some spices into your food and all of a sudden just those extra plants that you're adding in there, you're getting a health benefit from it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think when people hear the 30 plant challenge, which, you know, we've taught about it on the show and I've certainly heard it repeated across lots of different health thinkers. But I think people think like, oh my gosh, it's going to be kale and celery and spinach. And we only think of vegetables. But when we think of eating 30 different plants, it's fruits, it's vegetables, it's herbs, it's spices, it's seeds, it's nuts, legumes. Like, it goes on and on and on about how, about the varieties that we can add in. And, you know, me and my friends, we just have some jokes among us about, like, it doesn't matter what you're cooking, just put turmeric in it. If you're making a smoothie, just put the turmeric in it. I mean, I put turmeric in grilled cheeses and, like, all kinds of things because, you know, turmeric is a more mild flavor. It's just kind of earthy and nutty. And so let's go deep into the phenols versus the terpenes versus the aldehydes, because, you know, as I look at your periodic table of spices, some of these really make perfect sense. To say you can substitute cassia for cinnamon is basically a no-brainer. But then some of them are kind of like, wait, what? Like black pepper and ginger, and, you know, so some of them, there's bigger leaps in the profile of all the flavors. So before we get to the rest of my interview, let's take a break for a word from our sponsors. This episode of The Lindsay Elmore Show is sponsored by Sambucol. Now that the holidays are over and we are well into the new year, I like to assess all of my routines. What's serving me? What isn't? And is there anything I can add to help aid me in my health and wellness journey? This is where Sambucol comes in. I recently started taking Sambucol's black elderberry every morning to help support my immune system so I can keep doing what I need to do every single day. It's a simple act of self-care that I can do without much effort. Sambucol is made from premium European black elderberries, which are a natural source of powerful antioxidants and key vitamins like A, C, and E. They help support a healthy immune system so you can keep moving. And Sambucol has many ways to get your daily helping of black elderberry, like syrups, gummies, chewable tablets, drink powders, capsules, and more. They even have products for kids, too. My listeners can get an extra 15% off of their next order of $9.99 or more at SambucolUSA.com by using my promo code Lindsay15 at checkout. That's 15% off your order of $9.99 or more at SambucolUSA.com. That's code LINDSEY/15 at checkout. And here's a pro tip. Save this promo and the website address in your notes apps. I know you're busy, and oftentimes we forget things that we intend to remember. So head right now to SamuCallUSA.com and use code Lindsay15 to save 15% at checkout. And now, let's get back to the show. Talk to us about phenols and terpenes and acids and, you know, the sulfur compounds and how they all contribute to the flavors of foods.
Yeah, absolutely. There's and basically for listeners, there are, as I've said, I've grouped them into different, and there's the chemical name for it, but really don't need to know what the name is at all. It's just a sort of a placeholder that there is a reason behind these spices are grouped together. And as I say, these flavor compounds, they exist in the spice in the plant, as generally speaking, as a defensive substance. So it will be often if you take a spice, be it a peppercorn, be it or even an herb, you take a leaf of rosemary and you start chewing it. It's horrible. It's not very nice. And that's because these substances, these flavor compounds, are actually quite repulsive. That's why they make them. They're offensive. They're used to deter infections from pests and things like that. But the weird thing is that in tiny amounts, these unpleasant substances, so thyme, for example, the flavor compound responsible for thyme's primary flavor, it's called thymol. And that actually, if you get it in a bottle, it's got a hazard label on it because it's actually quite dangerous. But in tiny amounts, the smells actually take on a whole new fantastic properties. So there's one flavor compound called scatol, which is responsible for why poop smells really bad. It's responsible for the smell of feces, but in tiny amounts it smells lovely. It smells floral, and they put it into perfumes so that it gives it that those floral notes, just the weirdness of these flavor compounds. But sorry, you were saying about specific groups. So as I say, I've grouped them into different groups. There's these things called sweet warming phenols. Examples are, you know, the flavors that you get in clove and fennel, they actually have names. So clove, the principal flavor in clove is from a chemical called eugenol or anthanol in fennel. And those have similarities. So, you know, like kind of clove and fennel, they taste different. And like you say, with the ones that are pungent, they have heat, they have spice, the spiciness, the heat that we get from chilies, that we get from pepper, that we get from ginger. These, they have all very, very powerful chemicals in them, which again is designed as a deterrent from the plant being eaten. And it stores these flavor compounds up in these little bits of oil, in its most precious parts, which is why we go for the seeds, we go for the bark, we go for the roots. These are plant's most precious bits that it wants to defend. And so we take those. And ideally, what you need to do is you need to, if you've got the whole spice, which is ideal, then you break it down with pestle and mortar with a grinder, and you release those oils. Those flavor compounds are released. They evaporate really quickly, and that's why they have such a strong aroma and flavor with it. That's how you would make the best of your spices. But we have sweet warming phenols, we have terpenes, and as I say, terpenes are a huge category of different chemicals and different flavor compounds. So I grouped them into warming terpenes, which the responsible for the main flavor compound in nutmeg, for example, that's called saponine, and it's also the same in mace. Fragrant terpenes, so there's one called pinene, which is very, very common. It's sort of a piney flavor that you get with lots of things. Juniper, you get it in that. A thing called linalool, again, it's this very fragrant, lovely sort of fresh aroma, and you get that in coriander with a lot of other things. So, and they do have different flavor profiles, but what I try to do is to drill into the one that is primary and to then put that into that group. So yes, pepper is very different to chili. Chili gets its heat from a substance called capsaicin, which is actually, it's a poison. It's what goes in mace spray. And it's very irritant to the skin, to the eyes, and to the tongue, because that chemical capsaicin, it basically hotwires the pain fibers in our mouth to make the brain think the mouth is over is about 50 degrees C. So you get this sense of burning in the mouth. But there are other chemicals, other flavor compounds, one called piperine, which is what you get in pepper, and that has a similar effect. And so you have this warming effect. I did a cooking demonstration once with doing different making different spice blends for a group of people in a bookshop, bookstore, and I made one that was really hot and pungent. And I wanted to prove the point that you don't have to use chili in it to get it, and I just use pepper. And so yes, you can actually, for those when you're on that pungent kick, you can use pepper. You know, ginger also has a real pungent kick, which is why ginger is also in that group. And yes, has a different, a completely different, has a more floral, more complete sort of flavor profile than perhaps, you know, your pepper, for example. But you can still use it and give it that heat in your spice blend, and you can bring it in. So, and it's about you understanding these are the key parts of it, and yet there's a profile of other flavors. And actually, when we marry them together, and when we pick spices that share some of the flavor compounds, so linalool, for example, that's in coriander, but it's in lots and lots of other spices. So cumin, for example, also has linalool in. So although they taste quite different, because they share flavor compounds, that makes it they there's a crossover with the flavor compound, and that means that they harmonize together really well. And thus you can make your wonderful spice blends that balance together because they all got their different nuances, and yet they share lots of flavor compounds as well. And so this is how you can unwrap the scientific principles that actually aren't that complicated. And in the book, I give lots of, you know, tips on how to get the best of your spice, whether you soak them first, whether you roast them, whether you crush them, all these other different things. And you mentioned sulfurous compounds, and these are things that are definitely irritant. You get them in garlic, you get them in onions, but you also get them in mustard. There's another one. So the ones that are very
The
there's a
curry
great
leaf is
spice.
the other one you mentioned.
What's the other one? Sorry,
The curry leaf is the other one that you
curry
mentioned.
leaf. Yeah, curry leaf. There's one called asafoetida or hing, which not a lot of people have heard of. It's incredibly potent. It's also known as devil's dung. That was what it historically used to be called, and it was used as a treatment for flatulence. So, but I wouldn't recommend trying it. I don't think there's any evidence for that. You can try it if you're really struggling. But this stuff, it's utterly repulsive. You know, they normally put something in little tiny pots, and they mix it with something very inert, like a flower, just because it's so potent. It's a dried resin, but it's honestly horrible. But it's got these sulfurous substances in. But if you use it in the tiniest amounts, I'm talking like a fraction of a teaspoon, when you're cooking, let's say you're getting a curry on, Lindsay, and you've got your onions in, you're frying them off. First of all, we're getting them brown, and what's going on there? There's a chemical reaction on there called the Maillard reaction, spelled Mallard, the Maillard reaction, and that is releasing all these wonderful flavor compounds that you wouldn't get if you boil it. But you've got to fry it in the oil. You get those lovely flavor compounds. You add in a little dab of this thing called asafoetida or hing, in a tiny amount, and it develops all these flavors as well. But it has these really potent sulfurous substances in them, but in a tiny amount spread throughout the whole dish, it gives it a real meaty quality. And it's a way of making vegetarian foods just have a slightly more meaty quality to it, because sulfur is something that is found in flesh, in muscles, and so often the only sulfurous sort of element that you get from food might be from the meat itself. So by adding that in, you give it that lovely meatiness that you wouldn't otherwise get. So again, these are all just tips and things that you can use to harness the power of these incredible things that we really shouldn't just put in a cupboard and forget about them.
Yes, absolutely. So I want to play devil's advocate a little bit because there are a lot of social media influencers who are like, when you are eating these defensive compounds in food, your food's trying to kill you. You know, I mean, I listen to people that talk about how, you know, that like, for example, soaking chia seeds and how it creates that mucilaginous layer around it. I hear like the carnivore MD being like, that is literally the plant trying not to get you to digest it. And same thing with like oxalates in kale, etc. Why is spice fundamentally different than an oxalate or, you know, a plant, a seed that creates a mucus barrier to digestion? And why are these defensive compounds, which are repulsive if you take a full dose of them, so beneficial for us in small amounts?
That's a great question, Lindsay. Really great question. So I don't buy this thing. I mean, essentially nothing wants to be eaten.
Right. Thank you.
Nothing wants to be eaten. So, but we eat, we've evolved to eat plants. So yes, chia seeds, yes, they are trying to protect themselves, but actually they've evolved to be eaten. You know, plants have evolved to be eaten. Their seeds and their fruits have been designed to be eaten so that we eat them, so that we poop them out, so that they go into the soil and then they regenerate and they have the next generation. So yeah, absolutely. So, but is it harmful for us to be eating these substances? I say, well, no, the evidence bears out that it's not harmful, that a little bit of something in excess, you know, be it water, be it anything, will be harmful to you. But in small amounts, we have evolved, our body is designed to be able to enjoy all these different things. And actually, yes, we do need a little bit of all these things. And no, they're not harmful for you. They are designed to protect, you know, these many of these substances are designed to protect insects from burrowing in and eating them. But actually, our body is designed to have them. The microbes in our gut actually enjoy them. So you turn it on its head. No, it's not harmful for you. Actually, we are evolved, designed to actually eat them and enjoy them. And that's the great thing, is that it's enjoyable. You know, mm-hmm. It's healthy and it's enjoyable. And I think spices, they just, you know, they bring so much and so easily, so easily.
Well, and you think about our ancestors, if these foods were not beneficial for us and if they were truly harmful for us, we would have not eaten, we would have ceased to eat them by this point. It's, you know, there's a reason that nobody eats an Amanita phalloides, right? It's because somewhere along the way, somebody ate one and everybody was like, remember when Jack died after eating that mushroom? Don't eat that mushroom. But the fact of the matter is we have long, thousands of years of experience of using spices to enhance our cooking. So take us through the next step, because it's not just about learning about chemical constituents in food and spices. It's about how do we make delicious food. And so you go through and really give some science behind creating spice pairings and spice blends. And it honestly reminds me a lot about the discipline of aromatherapy, where you've got your floral and your citrus and your woodsy and your resinous aromas, and then your herbaceous aromas, and they don't all go together, right? You don't want everything going on all at once because it's overwhelming for the senses. So what is your theory behind how do we create better spice mixtures?
Yeah, there's a theory called flavor pairing theory, which is it's probably about 10 years old now. So, but in the sort of the scheme of sort of cooking and culinary world, that's quite recent. And that is on the, why is it that two different foods go together well? Why is it that tomato and cheese go together? Tomato, mozzarella and basil, why do they go together so well? One's a leaf, one's a, you know, a partly fermented dairy product, and one's a fruit. Why on earth do they go together? And scientists realized that when they started analyzing the flavor compounds in the different foods, they found that foods that go together well often share some of these flavor compounds. So there is crossover between the flavor compounds. So some of the flavor compounds in tomato will be the same as in basil, which will be the same as in mozzarella, even though they taste different, there are some overlaps between all three. And you can harness that principle to come up with pairings that you might never have ever dreamt of. And you can use this with ingredients, and you can use this with spices. So that is the principle behind how we pick spices that go together, that blend together well, is that we look at one spice and in the, yes, we've got the primary flavor compound, be it a warming phenol, be it a fruity terpene, be it a sour acid or a pungent chemical in there, but I also explained to you the other ones that are in there, and they have their own qualities to it. And within that, I say, well, this has got, say, you know, so say linalool, just as an example that I've used already. This also in other spices. So you can go, okay, I'm going to look at the other spice, and then I can try and blend them together. And then I've got those two primary flavors together, but then I'm blending them, I'm meshing them to make my own sort of flavor compounds. And that's the principles behind, you can basically have fun. You can have fun, really. That's the idea. But there's the historical things behind there as well. A lot of these have been worked out over centuries. That, you know, we know. So Chinese cooking is based on ginger, garlic, and then you'll have, you know, rice wine. You may have Sichuan peppercorns, star anise.
I was going to say chilies.
Chili as well, all these things that, and they, you know, they, this has been learned through experience, but we can sort of shortcut that with these scientific principles. So we're not ignoring the hundreds of years of tradition. We're saying, yes, this is fantastic, let's take this on. But then what do we know now with chemistry and with science that we can then use all that, endure that, but then play around with it, but do it in a really clever way. And that's kind of the principle of whole fusion cooking, the way we get things from across the world. So another spice that I love is called wattle seed. And that comes from the wattle tree in Australia. And the Aborigines used it quite a lot, and they probably still do, for medicinal reasons and in cooking. And it's got this beautiful, smoky, woody sort of aroma and flavor to it. And like anything else on the spice deck, on the periodic table, it's just wonderful. You can change it with other ones, but it's quite unique. And I like that. I like to use that and put that into other spice blends. So something that wattle seed would never have come into contact with, you know, all the other spices that I list in the book. But you take that and you put that in there into a different spice blend, and then you get this lovely new nuance or something, this whole fresh element that you wouldn't have had otherwise. So that's how we pair things together. That's how we get creative. And that's how we use the science to empower us to have more fun and more flavor in our cooking.
Oh, so one of the times that I was in Australia, I can't remember which trip it was, but we went on, you know, to go learn more about Aboriginal culture. And thank goodness they have that wattle seed, because when I found out that the boomerang was invented to help hunt flying foxes and that they made flying fox stew, I was horrified, to say the least. But it's one of those things where you have access to certain foods and you have access to certain flavors. And when you can put them together, it creates cultural dishes that are delicious. I mean, I cook a lot of Latino food, which, you know, in listening to The Splendid Table, I had no idea that Lebanese cuisine had such an impact on ancient Mexican cuisine. And that's where we get some of these same flavors coming together, where, you know, you think of oregano, for example, as something that is very Middle Eastern, but yet it's quintessential as an herb in Mexican cooking as well. And so, I would love to know some more of just your favorite spices that we may have never heard of. I mean, I doubt many people have heard of wattle. I'm a very experienced cook, but a lot of people aren't cooking with mace and annatto and, you know, fenugreek and celery seed, which is so clutch in Southern cuisine where I'm from. So what are some of your other spices that you're like, okay, you may have never heard of this, but get it into your kitchen?
One that I love, and it's probably something that people will have heard of, is called Sichuan peppercorn. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, it's fantastic. And a lot of people heard it, a lot of people haven't heard of it. But it is utterly unique. It's from a tree called the Chinese pepper tree. The Sichuan peppercorn is also called the Chinese pepper, or it's called the Chinese prickly ash. And again, it's a fruit that we're using as the spice. And it's a little red fruit, and then you dry it. Typically you dry it in the sun, you let the seed fall out, and then you've got this little sort of this fruit husk that's very dry, and that's your spice that you use. You can either best, as with all spices, they're best bought whole, because the flavor compounds in which are in the oils, they evaporate very quickly. And so the moment that you crush it, you blend it, you grind it, the oils are released, the flavor aromas, the flavor compounds are being dispersed into the air. And so as time goes by, it ages and it loses its flavor over time, which is why great if you can. Yes, you can keep spices for a long time, but as soon as you've ground them, don't leave them for too long. And I always say roast them as well beforehand. Every single spice is better if you roast it. And that's because of this thing I mentioned earlier, this thing called the Maillard reaction that goes on. When you get food between above 130 degrees C, I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, but above 130 degrees C, so above boiling, up to about 180 when it starts to burn, that is a sweet spot when things brown, when all of a sudden your sausages sizzle, your onions go brown. That's when the magic happens. That's when this Maillard reaction happens and you get all the flavors released. So you must roast or toast your spices beforehand or fry them in directly in the food before you use them to release all those extra layers, those Maillard, those browning reaction flavors on top of it. Mm-hmm. But as I say, come back to the Sichuan peppercorn. It has these substances in which are unique for this spice called sanchules. And they do this strange thing in the mouth, much like I've described the pungent heat of tricking your mouth into thinking that it's hot and burning. These similarly go and essentially the chemical goes and hot wires the pain fibers in the mouth to give a numbing feeling, and also has this strange effervescent fizzing sort of sensation that you only get with Sichuan peppercorns. And you can just get one and bite one and it tastes this weird, strange sensation again, but in small quantities, it brings that whole incredible new dimension to a dish that when you've had it in there, you get, oh, wow, that's that Chinese style flavor that I didn't know where it came from. So Sichuan peppercorn, I'd list that up there with the wattle seed as being a particular favorite.
And one that I love whenever I'm really doing well on these 30 plants a week challenge is, you know, have black peppercorns, Sichuan peppercorns, pink peppercorns, green peppercorns, and just white peppercorns. Like, you can have so many different flavors that all of a sudden it gets easier to envision yourself eating these 30 different plants every single week. And you are so right about the Maillard reaction. There's a chef that I love, and she always says brown food is tasty food, because when you get that amino acid interacting with the sugars, creating this browning effect, it is delicious. And I've heard chefs debate about whether or not to do stovetop browning or in the oven. The oven is kind of a more surrounding heat versus if you're doing it in a skillet, you do have to move the things around. And I also would love your opinion. You know, some people have multiple different like coffee grinders in their house, one that's actually for coffee and one that's for spices. I have a ton of mortar and pestles, and I think that most people use mortar and pestles incorrectly. Mortar and pestles are meant to be pounded. They're not meant to be drug around in a circle. And so talk to us about some of the practicalities of how you cook at your home, and perhaps just, you've got such gorgeous recipes and photography in your book. Talk to us about, you know, how you might use spices differently, you know, if you're crushing it or roasting it or grinding it, or talk to us about practical cooking for, you know, that people can apply to their everyday life.
Yeah, the first thing that I think the mistake that too many of us make is to add spices towards the end. Because you don't do that.
No, you don't do that.
Put it at the beginning. Put it where the oil is, where the fat is. You need oil and you need fat in any kind of cooking. The flavor compounds, they dissolve well in oil, which is where they come from, but they don't dissolve well in water, which is why if you shake in some garam masala or whatever it is, some spice blend that you've got, whatever it is, towards the end of cooking, that won't, you're pouring it into something that is now water-based. and it won't disperse. You just end up with little fragments of spice, lumps, particles scattered throughout, rather than getting the flavor compounds out that infuse into the oil and then disperse throughout the whole dish and infuse the whole thing. So that's the first thing, is to put it, use it at the beginning, brown it first. I mean, you mentioned about the pestle and mortar or the grinder. Personally, and there is some a teeny bit of evidence to show that the cutting with a blade has a different effect on the structure of the spice when it breaks compared to if you're pounding it in a pestle and mortar. My experience is that I've not been able to appreciate a difference between the two, so I just use a little grinder for my spices. I always roast it first, roast the whole spices first, and I do it in a dry skillet, and I prefer that to the oven because you can control it, you can see it. An oven, you've got to keep opening and closing. A much much better control. You can judge it when it starts to smoke, when the kitchen starts to fill with all the aromas, you're doing the right thing. But when things start to go black, the male reaction's gone the other end. It's gone to the next chemical reaction. It's called pyrolysis, which is burning, which is charring, which end with bitter, acrid tasting substances. But you can judge that really easily, and you can move it around. And then once you've roasted it, let it cool, and then use your pestle and mortar or use a grinder. It's easier to grind after it's been roasted as well, obviously, because coriander seeds, they're a nightmare in a pestle and mortar if you're trying to do it in pestle and mortar. But if you've toasted them, roasted them beforehand, then it's much easier because the cell walls have started to break down. You can then bash it much more easily. I like the grinder because you can get particles very small, which I like, because then the more the flavor compounds can infuse into the dish. So that my personal preference is to use a grinder, although I know, I've cooked with people from the Indian subcontinent and they will always use a pestle and mortar.
Thailand too.
Do different qualities of different things. But I think you've got to do what works for you. You don't have to follow a rule that says you must do this. Give it a go, see what works for you, and see which you prefer.
Oh, I love it so much. And so, everybody, go pick up not only The Science of Spice, but The Science of Cooking. And your newest book is called The Science of Living. Give us just, a brief introduction to each of the books and why people would pick them up.
Sure thing. I mean, originally I trained as a medical doctor and I left medicine 15 or so years ago. I was working as a hospital doctor and I left medicine because I was diagnosed with a brain tumor, left me with epilepsy. That meant I had to leave medicine. I then retrained as a teacher, as a lecturer. And then from there, I went into doing science communication, science writing, and I did wrote The Science of Cooking, which is all about, all this stuff about explaining how do we use the basic scientific principles of cooking to cook better. And sort of my passion is about demystifying the world of science. I went to teaching and I taught teenagers. They'd left school and they'd gone into a college to do a vocational, to a job kind of course. And my job was to teach them the science parts of their health and social care course, which they didn't like it, but I loved challenging their misconceptions, saying science isn't this boring thing about equations and chalkboards. It's actually about learning amazing stuff about the world around you and actually using it. And unless you can use it, it's not interesting. So, well, a lot of it isn't interesting, especially, for many of us. But and cooking is the way in which you can use science and in a really powerful way. So it's not about being academic, it's about appreciating the world in a different way. Spice, the science of spice, in some parts of the world it's just called spice. But I think pretty much everyone else moved across the science of spice. Was a follow-on from that about as and we've just talked about it today. A Science of Living followed that, and that is about health and well-being generally, and that is about busting the myths that we've all heard. You have to add 8 glasses of water a day. Do you really use most of the heat from ahead? What makes a perfect breakfast? What to have for lunch? Should I take a break for lunch? How often should I take a break? What's the secret to getting perfect sleep? All those things. It was my lifetime list of every single question that I could think of, put into a book and answered with authoritative science, but written deliberately. All my writings deliberately in a very easy to understand, light-hearted way. I hate jargon. That's my pet hate, is that if you can use a simple word, why use a complicated word? If I can't if my friend down the bar couldn't understand me when I'm explaining something, why should I expect somebody to understand it if I write about it in a book? That's my ethos. The Science of Living in North America and in Canada, I think, is also sold as Live Your Best Life. I don't know why, but the North American people obviously decided they didn't want science in the title, so they called it Live Your Best Life. Same book, although Live Your Best Life has Fahrenheit instead of centigrade and has, you know, American spellings rather than UK spellings, but they're the same book, so don't buy both of them. Well, you can if you want.
If you would like to measure your food in grams and not in cups and teaspoons and all the things, but in milliliters and all of it. It was quite an adjustment when I had to like shift and learn how to cook in Great Britain versus in the United States. I mean, number one, the ingredients that you have at the grocery store, many of them are very, very different. And you're just getting used to it. But yes, I love it so much. So listeners, you can go and check out Stuart's work at www.stuartfaramond.com and pick up copies of The Science of Cooking, The Science of Spice, and The Science of Living anywhere that you get books. Dr. Stuart Fairmond, thank you so much for coming in and being a guest today on The Lindsay Elmore Show.
Thanks. It's great to meet you.
Amare's Happy Juice is a delicious combination of three popular products, including Mentabiotics, Edge, and Energy Plus. When you mix the three of them together, it creates one drink to help elevate your mood, crush your to-do list, and enjoy every minute of the day. The three products that are in Happy Juice boost mood and motivation, help to provide overall nourishment and health for your second brain, aka your gut. It helps to enhance mental performance and provides the fuel that you need for a highly productive day. When you drink Happy Juice, you will be getting a comprehensive combination of probiotics, prebiotics, and phytobiotics that have been scientifically shown to improve mental wellness. We also have an all-natural, caffeine-free nootropic that helps to support our motivation and our focus. And Energy Plus is a next-generation energy product that delivers rapid improvements in your brain and your physical performance without any of the jitters or the crash that you might see from high stimulant and high sugar energy drinks. Head to lindsayelmore.com/happyjuice right now to save $10 when you purchase the collection of Edge, Mentabiotics, and Energy Plus. That's lindsayelmore.com/happyjuice to save $10 today. The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Derek Lugo. Sound design and editing is by Jive Media. Support The Lindsay Elmore Show by heading to lindsayelmore.com/podcast. Your contribution, no matter how big or how small, helps us to bring the best guests to the interview chair. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Share this and all of your favorite episodes with a friend and on social media. Be sure to tag @Lindsay Elmore Show and help us bring the pod to more people.